Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. This is where top performers share their secrets to help you achieve your personal and your professional goals. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my genuinely amazing guests, we bring you inspiring and actionable insights that are aimed to take your life and your business to the next level. Ranked in the top 2% of podcasts globally, this podcast really is a must listen. And again, it's because of my guests. So whether you're tuning in for entrepreneurial tips, career advice, or personal development strategies, get ready to turn inspiration into action, challenges into triumphs, and dreams into reality. And my guest today, Maisie Gansler, is the author of the book, I love this, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, and Other Lessons from the Food Industry for Creating a More Sustainable Company. And I have that book on my desk as we speak. Now, Maisie is the Chief Strategy and Brand Officer at Bon Appetit Management Company, a $1.7 billion with a B service company. And her book draws from her over three decades of experience leading Bon Appetit towards more sustainable business practices. And here's the thing that I love about this book, and I reread it over the weekend before we jumped on this call. The book provides five invaluable lessons for doing sustainability right, doing it profitably, and getting the credit you deserve. And it features her stories and lessons from the front lines in the food industry business to inspire and educate readers on sustaining and achieving sustainability in their own businesses. And it doesn't have to be a food industry. Trust me on this. I read the book. So the search, anyway, I'm talking too much. Good morning, Maisie. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. And tell us a bit about you and how you show up in the world.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me, Denise. How do I show up in the world? That is a great question. I think that I show up as somebody who's curious, a bit challenging, who loves to travel, loves to learn, and always has an opinion.
We're twins, except the traveling part. I don't enjoy that, never have. But other than that, we're twins. So what made you write this book? I mean, it's an amazing book. I was telling you in the green room that I will have books land on my doorstep 3, 4, 5 at a time, maybe just one at a time. And I will look at the book and then go look at my calendar and say, okay, this person is coming on 3 months from now. So I'll make a note, go back and read the book before I'm, honored to get you on the podcast. And I read it this weekend and I was telling you, I've got sticky notes all over it. And you made an excellent point, I thought, we didn't record that part, but something that I had said in the pre-interview that when, people who are marking up their books, I can't do it. It's against my religion. I just can't do it. But you made the point that a lot of people are saying, well, I'm going to highlight this, but that means I'm going to come back. I'm not taking the time to really pay attention to it now.
And I heard somebody when I was in college and studying a lot, somebody said, if you highlight something in your book, you're saying to yourself, I need to learn this later, as opposed to taking the time now to really absorb it. And most of us don't bother to come back later. So best to absorb something the first pass.
Exactly. And I will take sticky notes. I mean, these books, once they hit my shelves after I've read them and reviewed them and, had you on the show, they're kind of fat because they've got sticky notes all over them. But my point with the sticky notes is I will take the time because I know I'm probably not going to come back. I want to observe it, read it, absorb it now. But that sticky note is a reminder the next time I open that book, oh yeah, I already learned this. Good girl.
And the art of writing something also, even if it's just a note on a sticky note, helps us learn differently as well, using your hand and the motion. So I think it's a great technique.
It does work. How, I have to ask you, how did you get the title? You can't market manure at lunchtime. Where did that come? It's a brilliant title. When I read it, when the book landed here, I loved the whole look of the book anyway. And I looked at that and I started laughing. I couldn't help it. It's so fascinating.
Well, the title literally comes from a story that kicks the book off, which is when my boss, the CEO and founder of Bon Appetit Management Company, had been out publicly bad-mouthing the nation's largest pork supplier, who
Ooh.
happened to also be our pork supplier. He had spent 2 years on the Pew Commission for Industrial Farm Animal Production, and they had traveled the country seeing different ways of raising farm animals for food. And when they went to Duplin County, North Carolina, and they saw what's known as CAFOs, or concentrated animal feeding operations, which is a fancy name for thousands of pigs in one building. And they met with families that lived outside of these CAFOs, outside of these industrial hog farms. And he learned firsthand by smelling and then by talking to these families that the manure from the pigs drops through slats in the floor and is collected in what's called a manure lagoon. It's literally a pit of poop. And it creates a terrible stench. And the families that live in these areas have higher incidences of asthma, lung cancer, and other diseases. And he was so angered by it that he was out talking about it and railing against them. And the VP of sustainability for this pork company flew to our Palo Alto offices to say to Fidel, "Shut up. Why are you out saying all this bad stuff about us?" And Fidel was letting him have it. He was saying, "I want to do better. I want to buy pork that's raised without manure lagoons. I know it can be done differently." And I was sitting there and I was cheering him on. And I was also thinking in my head, though, how am I going to market this? How am I going to market manure lagoons at lunchtime? And that's the crux of the book. It's about making real change towards sustainability, real environmental or social change, but also getting market credit for doing so. So you need to be able to tell the story in a way that the press or your customers or your other stakeholders, your employees, can get excited about. And I think it's real hard to talk about pig poop while you're serving lunch.
The lagoon bothered me. I read that and went, "What?" Driving up and down California highways, parts of California, you smell, and it doesn't matter how tightly your windows are rolled up, you're gagging. So, I get it. And I don't live in California, but I was born and raised there, left a long, long time ago. But I have never gotten over that stench. It sticks with you. It gets in your hair. It's on your eyelashes. It just lives on you. I don't know how people can live around it. And they'll say, "Oh, we get used to it." How? How?
You might get used to it and it might become another version of like white noise, but as you say, it sticks to you. Those particles get in your body and there are health repercussions from them, even if you're not aware of it on a daily basis.
Oh, no question. So tell us what the result was. How what happened, from this conversation, and did things change for the better?
Well, it is a story with twists and turns. The pork producer listened to us, and I'd say we had a really good two-way conversation, which is someplace to start. I think oftentimes we demonize the person on the other side of the negotiating table from us or the person with the other perspective. And he came and really listened. And it turned out that taking on the manure lagoons was going to be a really hard thing to do because they are literally set in stone. They are concrete. So you're talking about not just the change of a practice, but the change of a physical building. So we grouped all of our concerns about pork production together and decided we could take on one issue first, and that was the issue of gestation crates. And I think it's a really important lesson that you probably can't do everything at once in sustainability. So pick off something that you can have leverage about and is also meaningful. We don't want to fall into the trap of just doing things that look good but don't actually make change. This was a really meaningful change, getting sows out of gestation crates. What a gestation crate is a physical pen that a pregnant pig, a sow, is kept in for the length of her pregnancy, her gestation. It is about the same size as she is, which means that she can't turn around, she can't walk, she can only stand or sit in the same place and keep her head forward to eat the exact prescribed amount of food that somebody has determined is the most efficient for her to make the most piglets. And she spends essentially her entire life in this gestation crate. And then when she gives birth, is moved to a farrowing crate, which is a little bit larger, re-impregnated artificially, and put back into the gestation crate. It's truly inhumane and a big issue amongst many animal welfare advocates. So we decided to take that issue on first and kind of table the manure lagoons for the time being. We weren't making progress on that. Well, we thought the pork company committed to gestation crate free pork. I went out and announced to people that we had gestation crate free pork, both within the company and externally on several conference stages. And then I found out that, actually, they didn't really mean gestation crate free pork. They meant the pigs were going to spend less time in the crates. So going from their full gestation, which is 3 weeks, 3 months, and I'm sorry, 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days, down to probably 3 weeks. So about a quarter of the time. And I thought, that's not what we talked about around that conference room table in Palo Alto. That's not what we agreed upon. And I felt kind of ripped off and lied to. So the first thing I did was I called up the Humane Society. I ratted myself out. I said, I've been out going around the country telling you and others that we have gestation crate-free pork. Turns out we don't. We have pork that is in gestation crates for a shorter amount of time. It's not what I meant. It's not what you meant. It was really important for me that they hear the story from me first. Right. We never want to be accused of greenwashing, of being untrue. So they needed to hear it from me and know that I was going to do something about it. They introduced me to another pork supplier, Clemens, who had a line of pork that not only used they used gestation crates for just about a week. So just to artificially inseminate the pigs. So much, much less. But they also handled the manure differently. They still collected the manure, but they didn't spray it on fields the way this other producer had. So it was a roundabout way, but we wound up getting at those manure lagoons and coming to a much more responsible way of handling manure. And I promise you, when you drive around the neighborhoods around those Clemens farms, you do not smell any pig poop.
Really? I would think that there would be no way to not have some smell.
Well, it's really interesting. One of the things that Clemens does is that in this same line of pork that we are buying, it's not all of their operations, but one section of it, they also don't use any antibiotics.
Oh.
And to do that, they're very careful about where they site their pig farms, about how the wind is moving, because the wind will also carry pathogens, about how they are not near any other pig farms, again, because of that transfer of pathogens. They often want to be up against a hill so that there's a blockage of air movement, and all of these things that contribute to making it safer for the pigs also means that you're not polluting in the same way. They are really trying to not have an exchange of outside environment with the pigs in a negative way.
I'm so glad we're talking about this because right now, people, I think, are becoming a lot more aware of what they're actually eating. And some of it's just frightening. It really is. And I grew up around farms, so I know exactly what you're talking about. But honestly, the things that are injected into our food, this is a little bit off topic, but when I go to my grocery store, which is most everything is locally sourced, it's a local grocery store. I think they have 16 or 17 stores now. I live very close to the Gulf of Mexico, very close. So I eat fresh shrimp all the time. They source it. They have their own boats. They go out to the Gulf and they bring home the shrimp. So I feel safe with that. But there are a lot, but once you leave the half of the store, which is locally grown produce and locally sourced seafood and, you know, foods, then you walk to the other side of the store, the lighting changes, the flooring changes, it's linoleum, it's not pretty over there, but the lighting is different because they want you to see all these colorful boxes and cans. And my attitude about that side of the store is you might as well just lick the cover. That's all nutrition. That's where the nutrition is. Eat the box because there's nothing in there that you should be touching.
There are so many horror stories around our food system these days. And I do in the book tell some of the stories of my personal interactions with shrimp farms and hog production I've just been talking about. But one of the points that I also make is that people respond better to good news. And if you're trying to market food systems change, it's really tempting to get stuck in the negative and get stuck in the horror. And then at the end go, oh, but we don't do that. When I found that it's more effective to lead with the positive, people want to feel like they're part of a better food movement, that they're doing right for themselves, for their children, for their communities, for the environment. And so I challenge anyone who is marketing a product that has a sustainability element to lead with the solution rather than lead with the problem, or else it's just a bummer.
It is. And listen, these days, I think people are tweaking to the fact that there are a lot of things in our foods that shouldn't be in there. They're not food. You know, they're manufactured cereal. I don't know why anybody eats that stuff. I never could stand it. But there are so many things that you look at that and you start reading the ingredients and it should be one or two small ingredients, real foods, not happening. Just that's not what. And I think people say, well, you know, we're getting fat, we're getting unhealthy. You think? What are you eating? Seriously, what are you putting in your tummy?
Right. I eat cereal a couple of times a year, but I think of it as dessert. I certainly don't think of it as breakfast.
It's sugar. It's sugar in a box. And I don't eat sugar right at all. But, you know, a friend of mine said, oh, you've got to try this oatmeal. I hate oatmeal. And I tried it and went, oh, okay, that's good. Red Bob or something like that. But I'm still not going to eat a lot of it. I'm just not a cereal or a breakfast person at all. But
probably Bob's Red Mill.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like them. But and it's not just food that we're taking in. It's what we're taking in on the radio, on the TV. It's scary. I'll be honest with you. I look at some of what's going on and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Seriously, you've got to be kidding me. And people will just seem to believe any old thing they're told, which is why I really love what you said. You got out there and got in front of it with the pigs. I mean, that was brilliant.
I really urge people to get out of their offices and go see what's going on in their supply chain, be it a pig farm like what I experienced, or even where your documents are being shredded, or, you know, whatever services you're paying for or products you're buying are being made somewhere, or there's people somewhere. And we can ask all the questions from our desks, and Zoom has been fantastic for so many reasons, but nothing is quite the same as going and meeting somebody on their own turf, and you will see things that you never thought to ask about. You will learn things that spark ideas and you will forge friendships that will allow you to create much greater change together than just through a customer seller exchange that involves a contract and money. The relationship is so important if you want to make change.
It really is. And I'm still in the introduction. I'm on page 3, but there's something that I sticky noted it. So you said that sustainability has become a buzzword in marketing, everything from food to clothing, from tourism to building, and in my case, podcasting or web development. And when it entered the common business lexicon, I heard two definitions applied more than others. And the first was meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And then there was a second one. In our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next 7 generations. And that came from the founding document of the Iroquois. I think I said that correctly. Iroquois Confederacy. These are not new ideas.
They are not. And interesting that even when there were so many fewer people on the planet, that the indigenous people were thinking about how they were using resources in a way that so many of us don't when we have so much more of a pressing crisis.
Well, and we have access to too much.
Mm.
Have you ever noticed that? Yeah, it used to be when my grandparents were still living, my great grandparents in particular, they were very frugal. There was no cleaning out the garage and the storage units. They had what they needed. That's what they used. And, you know, they left behind a bit of a legacy. They didn't, you know, spend every penny they had. They didn't have junk drawers. Mine needs to be cleaned out every 3 weeks. I swear it does. But we have access to too much stuff. It's just,
absolutely,
and we don't need it. And that, I think, has become a big sustainable problem.
Fast fashion, fast everything, right? Fast food, fast fashion, everything is accessible to us in 24 hours, if not less, through Amazon. You just think of something and you can have it. And it causes us to impulse buy things that we don't need. And then, to your point, store them and not truly use things to their full potential, but just as quick and easy, and then toss it.
Exactly. And I don't know about you, but if I've got a box that I moved into the garage 2 years ago and I stumble across it, chances are I'm not going to even open it. I'm going to donate it, because if I didn't need whatever was in that box and it wasn't important enough to store in the home, it's gone.
Well, you're a better woman than I.
It's not easy. Trust me. It's not, because there could be something important in there, but I can't keep all this stuff around. And I'm one of those people, if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. So I will find that I now own 2 bottles of super glue. It's like, really? I just needed one. But as I get Amazon, off we go. So it's interesting. There's a lot of things that are interesting. But when you were writing this book, Maisie, what was the thing that you really, really wanted people to understand? Was there any one point that you just needed to make?
Overall, I wanted people to understand that building a brand based on sustainability, no matter your industry, no matter the size of your company, takes forethought and strategy. I think that sometimes people look at a admired brand like a Chipotle or Everlane or Patagonia and think that the founders had certain values and then it just happened, that they just imbued their brand with it. When it turns out that people are making very strategic decisions, trade-offs, not being able to do everything they want all at once, and leveraging their values to get greater market share. One example that is in the book, I interviewed Chris Arnold from Chipotle. He spent about 15 years as the head of communications for Chipotle. And he talked about some of the ways they got the word out about their burritos. And the term guerrilla marketing is thrown around a lot. People say, oh, do guerrilla marketing, have street teams, do guerrilla marketing. Well, what does that mean? Well, for Chipotle, they were founded in Denver. That's where their first restaurant was. And the Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber's trial was in Denver. There were many, many reporters from around the country covering it. And Chipotle sent burritos over to the reporters, free burritos. And the people loved them and wanted writing all these stories about them. Some early readers of my book were really taken back by that, that there was this horrific thing that had happened, that children had been murdered and their murderer was on trial. And Chipotle was thinking about burritos. Well, that is in fact what guerrilla marketing is, looking for every opportunity to get the word out about your product. I thought it was a great example of leveraging an opportunity. Now, you may not want to use that at your company, but at least when you look at Chipotle and you say, how did they get all that press? You know the lengths they went to do it. So going back to your question.
It was also an act of kindness in many ways.
That is exactly how Chris saw it too. These reporters were working long hours. They couldn't step away. They were away from home in many cases. And isn't it nice to have some wholesome, good quality food show up for you?
Absolutely. Okay, keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. So I was just going to reiterate that these are people who do have sustainability in their heart. We're not talking about reading a what's hot this year sustainability list and thinking, how do we check that box off? I think that consumers can sense that. If you don't really believe in what you're marketing, I think they've got that BS detector that goes off. So these are people who truly wanted to make change, but also knew that it was a way to advance their business. Gary Hirschberg, who was the founder of Stonyfield Organic, known for their yogurt, talked about what a small marketing budget they had. And he said, my gross profits were smaller than the net profits of my competitors. I'll say it again. My gross profits, all the money they brought in before all of their expenses, was smaller than the net, the after expense money of my competitors. So I didn't have the marketing budget to do big commercials and traditional media. So he said, I need to make an emotional connection to my consumer, and that's going to be through shared values. And then he started putting messages on the lids of his yogurt. So a product he already owned that he was already printing, he then put sustainability messaging on to make a connection emotionally with his customer that they would remember.
That's brilliant. So you're reaching out to the customer who has your product in his hand. That's brilliant.
And having them create a sticky experience, remember your product, and maybe even tell somebody about it.
No kidding. So I wonder what caused him to, we have, I call them God winks. All of a sudden, you'll just have this thought. I tend to have mine in the shower. That's when I have my God winks. I'm like, ooh, and I take my bathtub crayons in there with me and I write them down because I don't want to forget them. But when you have these thoughts, sometimes, and this is a question for you, it's not me just stating it, is it best to run with it if it's really, you really feel strongly about it, or do you take it into committee, or do you do both?
Well, I too do my best thinking in the shower, and I think it's because it's the only place these days that we are truly free from distraction.
Yep.
Your phone is not coming into the shower, right?
It better not be. No.
Right. No. You're having a truly solitary thinking moment. And for me, I don't have bath crayons. I like that idea, but okay. I do come out and scribble things down.
Yeah, I can't, because by the time I'm dried off and I make it across the house, that moment is like, oh my God, that's brilliant. It's perfect. It's gone. I mean, I kind of got it, but that perfect sentence, it's gone. So bathtub crayons, when the mist clears, because I take my showers hot enough to steam broccoli, I go back in, take pictures of it, then I wipe the walls down, and my brilliance is still there.
That's awesome. The other place that I find I have really good ideas, and I won't admit to exactly which times this has happened, but if I'm at a conference and there's a boring speaker, I sometimes wind up with really taking notes on something totally different and having really good ideas because I can't do anything else. You don't want to be rude to the speaker, but you can write and look like you're taking notes, and then my mind is sort of shut off from what's going on around me, and I come back with these lists. And I say come back because, to answer your question, I come back to my team with these lists of sparks of ideas, and in my reading them to them, I can judge which ones spark them and also which ones I get excited about again, even if it doesn't spark them. And there have been some ideas that I have gone down a path on that my team has not stood behind me on in a positive way. You know, I never feel like they're rooting against me, but they don't quite get it. And I say, I know you don't get it, but this is what we're going to do. And I got about a 50-50 hit rate on whether those are actually good ideas or not. But I feel like, and I'm not the first one to say this, if you don't have some failures, you're not pushing yourself enough. You're not being
Yeah.
risky enough. It's part
Absolutely.
of the process.
It really is. And I think a lot of people, oh, I don't want to do this because I might fail. You're going to fail.
Absolutely.
Entrepreneurs know that we fail multiple times a day. We fall smack on our butts multiple times a day. Then we either stomp around, have a fit, go talk to somebody. I tend to stick my nose in the refrigerator. I call it my open refrigerator door syndrome. I will haul my butt out there, open their double doors, and I'll stick as much of my body in there as I can. And I just go blank. You know what happens when you go to the refrigerator, right? You're like, how did I get here? What am I doing here? And you just go blank. And I will snap out of it when the refrigerator doors and when the alarms ding. And I'm like, okay, back in here, and I'm good to go.
That's funny. There's a kind of a saying in the restaurant industry of go cry in the walk-in, which is everybody in a kitchen, in a commercial kitchen, has had some moment of breaking down, but you don't do it in the kitchen. You go cry in the walk-in refrigerator where no one can see you. You have your
It's cold.
solitary moment.
Yeah, and it chills you down, literally.
Right. Yeah. No, I find, actually, I agree with you. Failure is going to happen. In fact, lesson four of my book is called What to Do When You Fall Short, because I am sure everyone is going to fall short at some point. And for me, when I fall short, I have to be the first to deliver the message. Just like I called the Humane Society when I found out that we didn't have truly gestation crate-free pork, even if I just screw something up on a project with my own team. And when you're the boss, you know, people sometimes cover for you a little bit, but I am always the first one to say, I blew this one. This wasn't a great idea. I missed this deadline. I have to be the one to name it. It makes me feel much more comfortable to have it out in the open. And usually when you do, people are understanding, or you can quickly get to problem solving together, or to what's the learning in that failure. But when it's a secret, when it's hidden, when it's not talked about, then I find it becomes a bigger issue.
And it will be discovered.
Absolutely.
Well, so, get out in front of it. And you mentioned your lessons, and I'm back at the table of contents. You have lesson one, how to pick your battles. Lesson two, how to make sustainability your mission. Literally, we've talked a bit about that. Lesson three, how to make meaningful change. And the one you just mentioned, lesson four, how to fix it when you fall short. And then lesson five, how to tell your story. I'm going to throw this list back to you and ask you where you want to start.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Let's start with lesson one, how to pick your battles.
Okay.
One of the questions that I got from my editor was, why is that lesson one not make it your mission, which is lesson two? And in his thinking, it was, you start with creating the mission of your company, and then you pick the issues that add up to that mission. And I have flipped it because I think it's really important that operations goes first and marketing follows. And that's also why the last lesson is about telling your story. If you start with marketing, you start with the snappy tagline or the brilliant ad campaign, and you get ahead of the operations of your business, even if you're a single person, you know, especially if you're a single person, because it's hard to do everything at once if you're a solo business. I think you first change your practices, and then you start talking about the story. So the first step is to decide which issues you're going to take on. You can't take on everything. You just won't accomplish it. So I go through the different places you can get ideas from your customers, from advocacy groups, from your own passion, such as Fidel and his passion about manure lagoons. And then think about, which of those areas can I actually make change and get market credit for it? You can't market manure at lunchtime. You still probably want to do it, but that's not going to be the issue to hang your hat on. You need to have another one. And in our case, in that way, it was gestation crates. It was something that was being talked about by many advocacy groups. So we knew that there would be a lot of people celebrating change and helping us tell the story. That's lesson one.
And I'm not going to read it out, but I want people, when you get to this book, How to Pick Your Battles, lesson one, it starts with, please leave all your clothing behind the yellow line, enter the shower, wash with soap and shampoo your hair. Get the book. That's as far as I'm going to go, because I was reading it this weekend and laughing and then not laughing, because it's a very serious topic. But the way you presented it, I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. And it was. It was a great read.
I'm so glad. It's a weighty topic, but I wanted it to be fun and quick and interesting. And so a lot of stories, I don't know if you're familiar. Well, I'm sure you are. You're a top 2%er in podcasts, so you must know the podcast world well. But the podcast, How I Built This with Guy Raz, he interviews founders, and often I'll look at who's going to be on the show and I think, I don't have any interest in this person. Like, this guy founded Atari. I don't care about video games. And then through the stories he tells about how decisions were made, fails, setbacks, overcoming things, I think, oh, actually, that is applicable to my business. Oh, actually, I too had that problem with employees, even though mine was around food service and his is around video games. Oh, that's interesting. And oh, that's how they got the funding for their company. I wanted people to have that same experience with my book. I'm talking about food, but no matter what your industry is, through my storytelling, I hope that you can find some nuggets that apply to your business and spark your ideas.
And I'm glad you mentioned storytelling, because in this podcast, it's all about storytelling. I want to know your story. You know, I don't want a bunch of statistics. I want to know how you got where you are, what you're doing, what's coming. Tell those stories. Don't stop.
I think we learn so much better through example than through lists.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when I'm looking for my little sticky notes here, there's a couple of the pink ones are the ones I'm like, ooh, I like them. Those are my favorites. The yellow ones are, you know, kind of like, okay, I need to go back to this. I do, you know, I read it, I absorbed it, but I will need to come back to it. The pink ones are just me laughing because it's just so, but I'll be honest with you, those are the ones that stick with me because of the way you told the story.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Okay, so let's keep. Is there anything else in lesson one that you wanted to share?
No, let's move on to lesson two, which is make it your mission, literally. I really think that if you want sustainability at the heart of your brand, it needs to truly be the heart of your brand. And I learned that when going back again to my experience with Fidel at Bon Appetit, we had made a bunch of operational changes to be more sustainable. Again, I think you start operations before marketing. And we didn't know that customers would care. We just thought it was the right thing to do for the benefit of the best product, as well as for the health of our communities and our environment and our guests. We weren't talking about it a lot. And Fidel had an experience where he talked to some customers that had become aware of a decision that he'd made around boycotting a vegetable processor because of how they were treating farm workers. And they had said, "We want to buy your product because you made this decision." And he thought, "I didn't know anybody cared about this. I just did it was the right thing to do." And he called me up and he said, "Put a brochure together." And I put a brochure together. He came back and he said, "I don't want it just in this brochure, it being sustainability, corporate social responsibility." He said, "I want it everywhere." And he kept waving his hands around, "Everywhere, everywhere." And I thought about it and I came back to him and I said, "If you want it everywhere, then it has to be part of our mission." And at Bon Appetit, we don't have a mission statement. We have a dream. Again, to make that emotional connection, Fidel wanted people to dream about a different type of food service. And we wound up writing corporate social responsibility right into the dream of the company. So our dream is to be the premier on-site restaurant company known for its culinary expertise and its commitment to socially responsible practices. It is at the very heart of what we do. It therefore guides every decision we make. And we went and screamed it from the rooftops internally before we did externally, got all of our people on board to understanding that.
Did you have any
dream and really?
I'm sorry.
Did we have any what?
Any pushback internally? Did people say this is going to be too expensive or I don't know what you're talking? Did you have anybody say, "What the heck are y'all talking about?" I can't picture it, but I bet you did.
We sure did. We did. Remember, this was in 2004, so 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we weren't all as enlightened as a culture about what's going on in the food system. And so we had some chefs that said, "This is going to be a lot more work. It's a lot easier to just buy everything from one source, not have to go to those small farmers. It's easier to Amazon wasn't selling food then, but there's some big wholesale food supply companies that work almost like an Amazon. And it's a lot easier to just buy from them than to get a whole bunch of small farmers bringing you different things on different days." And so we had some chefs that said it's going to be too much work. And we had some of our leadership team that said clients aren't going to care about this. They're not going to pay. And we serve three markets, private colleges, corporate headquarters, and museums. And they said maybe some of the colleges will care, but the corporations are never going to care. Well, fast forward 20 years from then, I can tell you every single request for proposal we get involves questions about sustainability, every single one. We were able to be the leaders by taking the risk when it wasn't clear that's the direction the market was going. If you wait until the market tells you, you will never be a leader. You will always be behind.
You're absolutely behind. You're just trying to catch up. And then something else comes along. You're not in front of that either.
Exactly. And to those chefs that said it was too much work, it is too much work. If you feel that way, this is not the company for you. The chefs that make it here are the ones that don't think of it as extra work. they think of it as the best part of their job, that they get to work with these amazing producers and these fantastic products. You told the story about your grocery store and how different it is to see, smell, and most importantly, taste those local goods.
Oh, it absolutely.
It is definitively different. And if you're a chef that doesn't see that, then this is not the right company for you.
No, and these days, you know, we're hearing more about farm-to-table restaurants, and people are becoming far more aware of how food tastes, how it treats your body. We're becoming a lot more aware. And, you know, you mentioned antibiotics earlier. Nobody wants foods that have a lot of antibiotics in them. I'm sorry, you just don't. I don't even like, excuse me, drinking tap water, and I love water. It's my favorite beverage ever. But I can tell when they've dumped bleach in it. Like, oh my God, really? So, you know, it is what it is. But I think as humans, because we are allegedly living longer, we need to be far more aware of what we're consuming, whether it's what we're eating, what we're listening to, what we're reading. We have to be more cautious and aware.
Absolutely. And then lesson three is, I would say it's the densest one. It's the least sexy one. It's the one about aligning all of your systems. So you have this great goal now. Are all of the systems throughout your business in support of that goal? And what I mean by that is your compensation strategy. Does your compensation strategy reward your employees for working towards sustainability? Or does it reward people only for finding the lowest cost product? If it's the latter, you're never going to get people to do that extra work to find that great local product. They're only be looking for the cheapest product. Does your communication strategy support your quest for sustainability? When you do your corporate newsletters or put out a message to your customers through your social media or whoever you're communicating, are you telling stories of sustainability? If not, people within your organization will not value that they need to be working towards sustainability. So looking at your purchasing policies, your payment terms, everything down to your software systems. If you want to, for example, track how much of your how many of your suppliers are diverse, that's a big issue these days, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Do you have a way to actually physically track it? And that sounds so simple, but many of us have very buttoned up, financially focused software systems that don't allow for extra fields like minority owned. So how are you going to, especially if you're a big company with thousands of suppliers, figure out what percent of your spend is going to minority businesses? If you can't measure it, you will not be able to report on it, and you will not be able to hold people accountable for it, and you will not be able to tell a story. So it's things as nitpicky as your software systems that add up to being able to have a brand that truly makes change and can talk about it publicly.
That makes perfect sense. And I never thought of the software. And I should. I'm a nerd. I'm a nerd in stilettos. But I did.
We had an experience once. We used to, years ago, serve the cafe at Yahoo. And one of the customers was complaining that they always got a receipt, even if they paid cash. And she said, it's a waste of paper. Why do you give me a receipt? And the cashier said, well, there's no way to not give a receipt. And the customer said, oh, I'm a software engineer. That's my fault. And she meant it kind of on the greater, grander scale. Of course, she wasn't the one that designed the point of sale system, but that was a choice in the software to not have a way to not give a receipt.
You know, I was at the vet the other day with my 19-year-old cat and got some good news this morning, so that was good. But one thing I really like this when I'm paying my bill, and honestly, I think I live in the deep south. You ought to give us a fainting couch in the lobby so we can get past it all. But they always say, "Miss Denise, do you want a receipt?" Yeah, I do, because I have, a lot of pets. I have a lot of fold. I have one folder that's thicker by the year, but this is how I keep track of it. So I do need that receipt, but they ask. Not everybody wants it.
And sometimes you now have the option, my vet will email me the receipt, and I really like that. Then I'm not wasting the paper. And for me, I know exactly where to go. I just have a folder in my email with all my pet
Right.
receipts, right? So that works for me. It's great to give people flexibility for their systems. And we can translate that to business as well. Often our business systems are not flexible.
And I never even thought of that. I mean, and that's a good point. Okay, so we are going to run out of time in about 10 minutes. Let's go to the next lesson.
So the next lesson is what to do when you fall short. And as I said, you are going to fall short. This sustainability stuff is not easy. And if you're making leading goals, goals that will truly show leadership, which you need to do if you want your brand to be known for anything, you need to be a leader in that area, you're going to fall short. And I start off by telling the story of Belcampo Meats, which was a fully integrated butchery, meaning that they raised their own animals on their own ranch and then butchered them and sold them in very high-end butcher shops. And one of their employees went on Instagram Live, and he wasn't an influencer, he wasn't anybody with a big following, but he went on Instagram Live and he said, "This S word isn't local." And he cursed a lot. And he, more importantly, though, he showed packages of beef that were coming from Tasmania, from Australia, at a location where everything was supposed to be coming from their own farm. And their farm, let me tell you, was not in Tasmania. Well, fast forward, and I detail the whole story in the book, but we'll get to the punchline. Through their own internal investigation, they found out that they were, in fact, bringing in some meat from external sources, but that 94% of the time they were serving meat from their own ranch. Now, let me tell you, anybody in the sustainability world on the corporate side would be thrilled with 94% success rate. This stuff is hard. Supply chains change. You're right now, you are in the midst of a weather phenomenon that's going to disrupt supply chains for your whole area for weeks. People make mistakes, things go wrong. So 94% is actually a great, great success rate. However, because they had promised perfection, because an employee went out and was a whistleblower, because of how they handled it eventually led to the demise of that entire company. There is no more publicly facing Belcampo meat. And I think
What
it's a
did they do wrong? I mean, I read the chapter, I read the whole thing. So tell our audience where they really failed and lost their business.
Well, first they failed by not having the systems in place to track this and to know that number themselves, and to be able to proactively tell customers when things were different. So let's say that there was a shortage of meat, of beef from their own farm, and they wanted to still have it in their butcher shops. And so they brought in this product from Tasmania, and it was organic and grass-fed and had all of these other great attributes. I would bet money that if they put a sign up in the store that said, "Today, the beef is coming from X supplier, and these are the attributes. And in 2 weeks, we will return to our supply of the Belcampo raised meat." Nobody would have batted an eyelash. Maybe a couple customers would have not bought beef that day and opted for chicken instead. But there would have been no controversy, no scandal. So that was the first thing, not having the systems in place to catch it. and to be the first to tell the story. And instead, when they were outed, they continued to downplay and downplay and downplay, and more reporters went after them trying to uncover the truth. And it really blossomed into a scandal that should never have been a scandal.
It doesn't sound like it should have been a scandal. It was good meat. It was everything that they purported their other meat to be. They just needed to say, hey, like you said, for the next week or so, this is what we're offering, but we'll be back. Our supply chain, blah, 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 blah. We'll be back with the meat that you know and love. I mean, how difficult could that have been?
We all can understand when a company is having a hard time trying to do the right thing. And most of us have a great capacity for forgiveness or for cheering on those who are striving to do well. We just have to be let in on the information.
Exactly. And if we choose to say, well, I'll come back in 2 weeks, but you're coming back in 2 weeks, so it's okay. But if we think you're lying to us, tilapia, I won't touch it. Mm-hmm. Got a really bad reputation, and I love fish, but I will not eat tilapia because I don't ever know where it's coming from.
It's probably coming from China.
Yeah, I think that's what I've learned. So I don't touch it. Seriously, I don't.
Mm-hmm. And then the last lesson is how to tell the story. And as you've heard me say already several times, that's the last piece of it, is telling the story. Once you have your system, you've picked your issues, you have your systems aligned, you have done the work to make sure that your story is true, then you go out and you tell the story. And I give some very concrete pointers on how to talk about these issues. First, to make sure that everybody in your organization truly understands them. We're talking about science. In my example I gave, I'm talking about gestation crates. It's kind of an awkward term. I have to learn to say it physically, as silly as that sounds, or to say non-therapeutic antibiotic use. Some of these terms don't roll off the tongue. Then I have to make sure I understand it and that I can explain it in layman's terms. If you're listeners can think back to the beginning of this session when I talked about gestation crates. I then went on to very quickly say what that is a pen the size of a sow's body. I explained, I don't assume anybody knows what that means. And so with sustainability, if you're talking about net zero goals and carbon intensity and offsets, do your customers understand the science behind all of those terms and why what you're saying might be slightly different than what a competitor is saying? You have to be able to explain it in plain language and in engaging language. Best if you can lead with good news, as I said, and do trainings throughout your organization so everybody can tell the story. I was at a restaurant recently and one of my dining companions ordered chicken. And when it came to the table, it was just huge. And he went, oh my gosh, that's a really big chicken. And the server quickly said, oh, you don't have to worry. We don't buy chickens that are shot up full of hormones. And I thought to myself, actually, the use of added hormones is not allowed in the United States. You can't sell chicken that has added hormones. So nobody is selling chicken that's shot up with added hormones. The issue, how you get those big breasts, is through genetic selection and breeding of chickens. And now I'm in my head having a whole conversation about this chicken breast, and I've missed everything else that's been said about the food being delivered to the table, and I'm not enjoying my meal. I'm having this internal dialogue about how the waiter is wrong about the science. You don't want that experience for your customers. So make sure that not only the purchasing team that's buying the products, but also the people in your sales team who are selling the products, be it selling paper or chicken or server farms or whatever you're selling, understands the science and can explain it.
See, when he said that, I instantly in my head looked at that chicken and said, I'm not eating that. I don't care what he said. That's just wrong. There's something wrong with that chicken. I mean, I would have instantly gone negative.
Yeah,
And
so how we tell the story is part of how we get the market credit that we're after.
This is amazing. Listen, I'm going to suggest to everybody listening, get this book. This isn't just for the food industry. The strategies and the tips and the way she communicates through storytelling can be used anywhere you are. I have several pink notes all over the place that I will be using for my podcast. So it's like, oh, that makes sense for me. Oh. And clients. I'm like, oh, that makes sense for my clients. And I've got their notes, you know, their names on those sticky notes. This is a terrific book. So anyway, Maisie, where can people find you? I really appreciate, you know, your company today. It's been fascinating. Do you have any last thoughts to share? And how can listeners connect with you on the web?
Thank you so much, Denise, for your kind words. When you write a book, it's a pretty solitary experience and you don't know how it's going to impact people. So it's really heartwarming when people say that they're getting use out of the book. People can find it, of course, on Amazon, as you can find everything, but also at your independent bookseller, including bookshops.org, and on my website, which is maisiegansler.com, just my name.com.
Spell your name.
Maisiegansler.
I was telling you in the green room before my virtual green room, my mom had a cousin named Maisie, and I thought her name was so pretty that when I got home, I named my kitten Maisie. I love that name.
Well, that is high praise because there is nothing more lovable than a baby animal.
She was a little calico. Maisie, she slept on my pillow. When you get your first little cat, and I was young, and I thought, that's an interesting name. It was better than Bertha, who was her cousin. But Bertha is my car's name because she's big and she's powerful. She's a Bertha. Names mean things. Well, listen, where you've already told people where they can find you. Do you have any last thoughts before I let you go, reluctantly let you go?
I just tell everybody that you can change the world. And I hope that this book gives you some steps to take towards that. Change your little corner of the world, change a big part of the world, but do your part to shape the future that you want to see.
That is lovely, and thank you. Well, listen to our audience. As we conclude today's episode, your feed means a lot. And if you found this show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. And this is why your input is vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals. So don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your part in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to go find Maisie Gansler on the web and connect with her. And listen, buy this book. You're going to love the cover. The cover is just... I looked at that and went, I started smiling. It's the neatest looking cover, but what's in it is really what's important. So thank you for tuning in, everyone, and I will see you next week. Maisie, again, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a true pleasure.
That's what I was just thinking. Thanks again.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.